Good morning. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Janine, and this is Get the Funk Out. And if you've never heard my show before, you could visit the show blog, which is getthefunkoutshow.kuci.org. And if you're not familiar with our incredible mix of eclectic shows here at the station, you can visit kuci.org. We have public affairs shows, we have music shows, we have a wide variety of talent. And you can also check out our socials at KUCI FM. So standing by to join us on the first half of the show is author Jennifer Rossner. She is a National Jewish Book Award finalist and author of The Yellow Bird Sings. She's written her next book, which is a riveting book based on the true stories of children stolen in the wake of World War II. It's called Once We Were Home. Let me tell you a little bit about Jennifer before I bring her on. So, as I mentioned, she is the author of two other books, and she also wrote If a Tree Falls, A Family's Quest to Hear and Be Heard About Raising Her Deaf Daughters in a Hearing Speaking World, and the children's book, The Mittens Spring, a Sidney Taylor Book Award notable. She studied philosophy at Columbia and Stanford and lives in Western Massachusetts with her family, and she's joining us now. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning.
Congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. I love interviewing authors. As I mentioned before we started, I'm a writer as well. I was fascinated with the fact that this is, it's fiction, right? Historical fiction?
It is.
So,
but it's rooted, rooted in very true stories, yeah.
So I want to start by asking you, how did the idea come about for Once We Were Home?
Yeah, so this story is complex. It weaves together the stories of four different children, but the idea initially came regarding one of those storylines. So I had been interviewing people for my first novel, The Yellow Bird Sings, which was about a hidden child and her mother during World War II. And while I was talking to a man who had been hidden, he introduced me to his wife, she had survived the Holocaust in a Siberian labor camp. And when she returned to her village in Poland, she learned that something like just 3% of Jewish children had survived, and most of them were in Christian settings with assumed identities and, you know, fake names. Mm-hmm. And she joined a mission to try to find those children and retrieve them, or like return them back into the Jewish fold. They weren't going to be able to go to their families because their families had perished. So okay. It was kind of complex, but, you know, where were they going to go? Some of them ended up in Jewish orphanages. Others got on transit to Palestine to join a kibbutz. But when I learned of that storyline, you know, I had never heard of this mission, and I had never heard of, you know, kind of going back in and trying to take children from those places. And then I started learning about other stories of children who were moved in wartime and became really interested in that. And so it actually, now the novel weaves together stories of Jewish children who are taken from place to place, and also non-Jewish children who are moved in another program for Germanization, et cetera.
Okay.
And that, you know, the effects on these children regarding, you know, identity and sense of home and faith and all kinds of questions.
And tell me about the characters, because, you know, when I read this, it just felt like it wasn't fiction.
Yeah. So, I mean, the novel weaves together these stories of a brother and sister, Oscar and Anna, and I purposely make their ages quite different. So Oscar is only 3 when his parents hear of a liquidation in a ghetto, and they stow their children with this farm family in Poland. So Oscar is just 3, and over the course of the war, 4 years, he doesn't really remember his Jewish roots or his family much at all. His family is now this Polish farm family that he's been with, whereas his sister Anna is 7 when that happens, and she does remember her Jewish roots, so that when an operative for what they were calling the redemption of Jewish children, but we can talk about that word later, comes, for Oscar, it's like he loses the only home he ever really knew, whereas for Anna, there's this spark of interest that maybe she's going to go somewhere that's, you know, in some sense closer to home. Mm-hmm. So that's one storyline. And then there's a boy, Roger, and he's based on a tr- true case that made a big splash back in the day. You know, there were these brothers called the Finnelly brothers, and they were stowed in a convent for safekeeping, and relatives did survive the war, and they came to try to get him back, and the church actually took these brothers on the run and hid them, and they didn't want to return the children. And so that was another case of children sort of being moved in accordance with kind of an ideological idea of where they should be, where they belong, or what, you know, home would be for them. And so in that case, in the real case, you know, clergy ended up in jail, and mm-hmm. this scholar, you know, learned from these archives that recently opened that, you know, the order to keep them within the Christian fold went very high up in the papacy. They didn't want to return them. They had baptized them after the war and wanted to keep them in Christianity. And then the fourth child in my story, Renata, is a girl, a Christian girl who's in Poland when Nazi soldiers take her and bring her to a Germanization center to be measured. And she passed the caliper test and the eye charts and the hair color charts and all these sort of things. She's Aryan enough looking. She's adopted into a German home to be Germanized. And so there was this whole movement. Also, there were just these histories I hadn't known about, and I had done a significant amount of research into this time period, and I hadn't known of any of these three kinds of ways children were moved. But, you know, in light of, you know, Ukrainian children who are moved and a whole history of children moved,
yes.
You know, under different circumstances, I thought it's really important that we understand that we do this. We've done this over history, and this happens, and the children share something. Even if all the circumstances of their movements are very different from each other, mm-hmm. they share certain struggles that are really important for us to know about, you know, about how they reroute after that kind of rupture and how they figure out who they are and how to relate to other people and
sure.
and how they move forward.
Do you think because you are a mother that impacted your ability to submerge yourself even more in the story?
It absolutely did. And it was really, actually, you know, the moral blurriness of it, you really feel as a mother, because you see, when you think about a child like Oscar, who is, you know, he's not with his, you know, original family, but he is attached to this new family, and then he's taken away, and all his, you know, it's sort of a rupture of attachment, and you really feel for children who are in these situations where mm-hmm. they're trying to create connections, and then for one reason or another, they're pulled out, and now they're, like, left without that, and you know, it's interesting because there's a sort of also really personal inspiration for this story, which is that when I learned about all these children sort of being moved here and there for, you know, some kind of higher level adult thinking mm-hmm. about where they belong, it hit this close nerve for me because my husband and I have two daughters, and they were both born deaf. And, you know, initially there were so many people with opinions about where our children belonged, who should raise them, should they be with hearing people, should they be with deaf people. And so this issue about, you know, where does a child belong, you know, mm-hmm. and is the most salient thing connection, or is it something else like
yes.
religion, or, you know, et cetera. So this, it was a very personal book for me in a lot of ways.
Yes. People actually said to you, where should you, like telling you where your children should be raised?
Yes, they did.
Wow.
You know, I wrote an article for the New York Times at the time, and I was talking about how, you know, in every community around the world, you know, parents, they give birth to a child, and that child automatically inherits the language and culture of their parents, mm-hmm. you know, of the parents. But with deaf children, and this is really, you know, 90% of deaf children are born to hearing parents. And so there is, you know, this feeling like, you know, should we bring them into the hearing world? But there are also people who feel like, no, they're deaf children, they belong with the deaf. And so that's a big controversy, and it's actually something I'm working on in a new novel about kind of all the thought processes that go into this, because it's such an interesting, specific case where...
Yes.
Because our kids didn't, you know, have bent or broken cilia in their ear or, you know, mm-hmm. some reason, this is a determinant of, you know, where they should be raised and how they should be raised and what language and what culture. And I understand it from all the sides because there are, you know, arguments on all sides. But it was very startling as a new parent who just wanted to be, you know, bonding and intimate and close with their child.
Sure.
To be faced with all that kind of political...
Those opinions. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we all know that, you know, people have opinions about parenting anyway.
Of course.
You know, whether
yes.
you should, you know, call diapers, breastfeeding, you know, everything.
Yeah.
And but this was really profound.
I would think so. And traumatic.
That, yeah, it was yeah. a layer on top of some other layers. That
yeah.
It was very startling. And so I think when I met this operative who, she felt really clear that she was, you know, a lot of them felt this moral imperative to retrieve the children whose parents stowed them in a Christian setting, not so that they would grow up their whole lives in a Christian home, but rather just so they'd survive the war and the parents hoped to come back. And then they perished, so they didn't. And so these operatives felt some kind of moral pressure, like they'd be, you know, returning the child and sort of honoring the last wishes of the parents who died, and also trying to rebuild this collective that had been, you know, hugely annihilated. And also I think they felt pressure because, you know, especially Poland, but many other countries, I mean, anti-Semitism was raging after the war. So mm-hmm. even if these children, you know, were with a loving family, there were villagers and neighbors and maybe these young survivors who lost their whole families, you know, it felt hard to walk away and just leave children in these settings.
Well, and was it hard for you to end this book and feel like, wait a minute, should I revisit it where they are later on in life?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, and one thing I'll say is that in reading the testimonies of operatives who did this work, many of them did follow the children that they moved. And some of them called it rescue. Some of them called it, you know, retrieval. Some called it ransom because they were offering money to get them, et cetera.
Okay.
But in any case, they followed, and some of them followed their children, you know, the children that they moved, and saw that, you know, some of them were able to kind of regroup and make a good life, and others were quite damaged. And and so in a way, I was following, you know, some of the children as I read these operative testimonies and saw that they had some retrospective questioning and slash regret about whether it was the right thing for every child. It was maybe for some and maybe not for others. And in terms of my characters, you see them up until they're about 28, and mm-hmm. you see that they're working on how to be in relationships and what is home to them and how do they settle. And yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to know what happens when they're 40, you know,
exactly.
60, et
yes.
cetera.
And how their childhood affected them as into adulthood. And one thing,
yeah,
that,
and I appreciate the sequel idea too.
it really made me think, like, wow, how did she close this? Because I would think maybe in your mind, these characters come to you probably late at night or early in the morning when you wake up.
Yeah, they do. I mean, you get so connected to these, you know, individuals that, you
yes.
know, because you're really close to them. You're, you know, I'm writing in close third, and I'm, you know, to some extent behind their eyes and in their hearts and
yes.
feeling all their feelings.
Yeah. I think what struck me too is there was a line someone said, when is Hanukkah? And I studied screenwriting, and I could just imagine, you know, you think about what is your earliest childhood memory, right? You probably remember things when you were three, maybe four, for sure, right?
I think so.
So you
yeah.
think when a child is taken very young and they have these memories and then they're living with someone that's not even Jewish, what do they do with that, you know? They just
yeah,
suppress
and
it.
Also they're under so much pressure to be hiding. You know, these children of war, in order to stay alive, you know, couldn't let any bit of Yiddish out of their mouth, and they couldn't say their real name, and they had to stay hidden in many ways. Boys couldn't pee in the woods. You know, there were all these kinds of things that were very important for their safety. And so I think a lot of children kind of swallowed down their past. And it made for a lot of complications, you know, when later they were brought back and said, you're Jewish, you know, many children burst into tears because it had been so dangerous to be Jewish. It's not that safe either, right now
mm-hmm.
either, but
right.
it's, you know, it was so dangerous, and they were, you know, they had been sort of instructed to hide. And, you know, so it's just very, very complex. And I've heard and interviewed people who, you know, really didn't get comfortable, like, readjusting to their original faith, you know, until they were in their, you know, 60s and 70s
mm-hmm.
and had had a lot of time to process. But as a young child, it was just, you know, very stressful.
Sure. And, I mean, you don't feel safe.
Exactly.
You know? I remember growing up in New York City, and my grandmother had given me a Jewish star, and my mother wasn't very religious, and she said, you can't wear that around the city, because she was worried,
yeah.
you know, something could happen to me.
Yeah.
You
yes,
know?
Especially people who, you know, were you know, living in that time or mm-hmm. near that time, mm-hmm. it was visceral, you know,
yeah.
It's very, very complicated for a child growing up under those kinds of conditions.
Definitely. Where did you grow up, by the way? In Massachusetts?
I grew up in Connecticut.
Oh, where? I grew up in Stamford as well.
Oh, my mom lives in Stamford. I grew up in Weston, Connecticut.
I know Weston.
And now my mom lives in Stamford. Yeah.
That's so
and
funny.
I went to college in New York, so we were circling nearby each other. I went to Columbia.
I'll have to talk to you another time, but one of my close friends, Jane, is from Weston.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you after the show what her last name is.
That would be awesome.
You probably know her. So when you were writing this book and your other writing, I can't help but think this would make an incredible film. Have that occurred to you?
Thank you. I actually am in conversations with film people both about The Yellowbird Sings and Once We Were Home. And The Yellowbird Sings is a bit farther along, but mm-hmm. there is interest. And we'll see, you know, how it is with film. I mean, it turns on a dime and,
yes.
you know, a lot of stuff is in works until it isn't. But fingers crossed, you know.
Well, I just sense that because especially listening to you, I mean, I speak to a lot of authors and I can hear, you know, how passionate and how much you put into this book and just the stories and that you're a mom. And I could just imagine this like in a film festival, and specifically even a Jewish film festival, the impact this would make.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome. So I want to dive into your process for writing this. Did you know how this would unfold, or did you just, as you were writing, new ideas, new twists and turns would come to mind?
Yeah. I didn't really know where it was going. Whenever I've tried to kind of plan in advance or outline or plot things out, to me, I find it makes the writing contrived
mm-hmm.
because you're sort of writing with this end in mind. And so I do the thing that's much more maddening and frustrating, which is just try to write and have faith and hope that it'll figure its way out. And I had once heard this amazing comment by a writer. I wish I could quote who it was, but it was, the idea of it was that, you know, each scene, you put out scenes, like, mm-hmm. you know, and the scenes are like stars in the sky, and then you connect them with, you know, a line, which makes a constellation, but there are so many different lines you might draw. So I think I work by just putting out the scenes that come to me, like this moment, or that moment, or this moment, and they're not in chronological order necessarily, and they're just things that I think of.
Sure.
And then you have the kind of, I don't know, higher order work of figuring out, you know, how do they fit and what order, et cetera. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, having a little trust or faith that the brain is working, you know, in a certain way, and that we are storytellers and we love narratives, et cetera, that mm-hmm. ultimately something will come. But it is a little worrying at certain times when you look in your computer and you think, wow, I have no idea what's going on here, but I'm going to just keep trying.
Well, isn't that like with any writing, like you write, people say you write a lousy, I'm changing the word lousy,
first draft.
And then you kind of peel it away, and then, you know, maybe you've written three chapters, but you realize that your story really begins in the fourth chapter.
Exactly. And, you know, with The Yellowbird Sings, I had written out, you know, something like, I wrote out something like 20 years of the situation, and then I ended up only keeping 5 of the years in the main part of the book, so that I had to go back in and kind of basically cut a lot and expand a lot. And but it was just like, this is the part that, you know, needs the focus and, you know, the fine-grained kind of build-out. And you only learn that sometimes by writing it all. And sometimes that 20 years, even though if no one else saw it, it informed things.
Oh,
that,
definitely.
You know, so even when you you write far back in the past or in the future, it definitely affects your writing of what, you know, what does show.
Well, you're writing the backstory. You might not share that backstory, but that helps you create the characters, the character arc, where you're going, maybe gives you different ideas, but you don't have to ever share that whole backstory. It's maybe an exercise for you as the writer.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because I really am a big believer in off-book writing, meaning having a pad to the side. Mm-hmm. No one else is ever going to see that. But you're working on like an image, and you want to brainstorm everything that has to do with it. And, you know, in my work, it turned out that string plays this big role that, you know, was really in certain ways showing up unconsciously. But, you know, I had learned that in my own family with our deaf daughters, I ended up researching and learning that we had great aunts who were deaf who had, when they put their babies to bed, they would tie a string from their wrist to their babies at night. So in the dark, if their baby cried, they would feel the tug and wake to care for their baby. And then, you know, later after I was, you know, I've written The Yellowbird Sings, and it's about this child who's a violinist who's, like, in some ways calling out to reach her mother in the night. And I hadn't really thought that, you know, a violin is a stringed instrument, and she's calling out to her mother. And in Once We Were Home, there's also a kind of string through, like, tree branch and tree roots. It's like Oscar puts his hand to a tree and hopes that root by root by root, his message will get back to the family, the farm family. And so it's, but I don't even really understand I'm doing that at the time. And then later when the book is done, I'm like, there you are.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's funny. I had written down a question. Is some of your own family history intertwined in these characters?
Yeah. So, I mean, that in some sense, I think my great aunts are always in my work. And because I think they were like this inventive and innovative and like this incredible model of connection and mothering and listening and, you know, and so, they seem to play a big role. And
that's great.
I think that there's a lot about, you know, connection and parents, you know, child and parent connection, which has a lot to do with personal material.
Sure.
Yeah.
What about, did you have a strong relationship with your grandparents?
You know, I had both, I knew both my grandmothers and neither of my grandfathers. They weren't alive.
Okay.
And I was close to them. I don't know if I'd say it was super strong.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's been interesting to realize too, you know, my dad had played the violin every day of his life, and he had even composed some music that was very, in some ways, haunting. And when I ended up working, these two novels are set in World War II and the Holocaust. And, you know, whenever we travel and you go to a museum and you see Rosner, you know, there's definitely these family reverberations through these two pieces of historical fiction for me. And now the new thing I'm working on has to do with deafness. So again, it's quite personal. So I think for me, it has to be a pretty personal to get to the desk every single day, because I think I'm working on things and sorting and trying to understand things through my writing.
Yes. Did you always want to be a writer since you were little?
No, I wish I had known I loved writing, but I didn't discover it, honestly, until after our first daughter was born.
Oh.
And I took to journaling for the first time. I had never journaled, and I found it so nourishing just to try to sort out what was happening and how I felt and all the decisions we had and everything. And those snippets actually became, they became a part of a memoir I wrote called If a Tree Falls, which is about deafness in our family. And But no, I actually was, I got a PhD in philosophy, and I was a professor of philosophy, which, you know, is really fascinating and intellectually stimulating, but also I think I missed the emotionality. And when I started journaling, it kind of all came together for me. It was like, wow, I mean, it can be intellectual and emotional and close and, you know, really part of your life in a certain way, not so abstract or separate.
Yes. By the way, as a side note, I remember taking a philosophy class at Syracuse University, and it was logic. And did you do really well in that class?
I wouldn't say logic is my best subject, but I have to say Syracuse has a terrific philosophy department, so you're probably, you know.
They do. Yeah. But I bombed that class. I had to retake it. It was so hard.
It's very hard, and if you miss one step, it's like the train is out of the station and you can't get back on. You know, it's really hard.
It's so hard. I just remember all those symbols, if, then, and the symbols, and whoa. So I think you're amazing with your PhD in philosophy. Where can people find out more about a book tour and find you on social media, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, my website is probably the best, which is www. Jennifer-Rosner.com. Okay. So there's just a dash between my first and last name. Okay. Jennifer-Rosner.
Okay. And have you been doing a lot of book tours, like even Brookline Booksmith or anything where you are?
You know, I did go, I was at, I think I was at Booksmith. Mm-hmm. Is that right? I was in the area over there. I have to go remember. I've been to a lot of bookshops, and I was doing quite a lot of events all through, you know, the Jewish Book Fairs time in November, and because the book was in hardcover and now it's in paperback. So, yeah, there's a lot of events on my calendar, many, many in the past and just some coming up now, but
That's great. Well, thank you so much for calling in, and congratulations on your book. I really enjoyed having you on the show.
Thank you. What a pleasure to talk with you.
You too. Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Jennifer Rosner talking about her latest book, Once We Were Home. She got some great reviews. This is what Booklist had to say. A complex tale about fear, survival, and what it means to be a family. Publishers Weekly said this. An engrossing story inspired by the post-war lives of Jewish children who were hidden during the war. Fans of Jewish historical fiction will be moved. And let's see, Kirkus, a carefully crafted and heartbreaking book. You can learn more about Jennifer by visiting my show blog, getthefunkoutshow.kuci.org, or you can visit her website at jenniferrosner.com. There is a dash, so it's Jennifer-Rosner.com. And if you've missed any part of this conversation, I'll be up on the show blog within an hour after I wrap. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.